This is Bob Williams at the Cosmos Club in Washington, D.C., interviewing Mr. Melvin S. Day. And Mr. Day, I have that birth date, that you were born January 22nd, 1923 in Lewiston, Maine.
Right.
Is that right?
That's right.
Well, tell me about your parents and growing up in Maine, one of my favorite states.
Oh, is that right?
And those kinds of things.
Well, I was born in Maine, in the state of Maine. My folks moved to Boston when I was about a year and a half old. And we lived in Boston until I was 13 years old. Then we moved back to Maine again. This was during the Depression. When we lived in Boston, I was privileged to go to Boston Latin School. 1936. In those days, you could go to Boston Latin School for either a six-year stint. A six-year stint or a four-year stint. You could either go into the seventh and eighth and then 4 years of high school, or you could go directly from high school. I was young enough so that when I went into Boston Latin School, I was in the seventh grade. And I guess it was 1935, 1936, I was in Boston Latin School. And it's a real great education. It's a tough school. If you go into the seventh grade, you take 6 years of Latin, 4 years of Greek, 2 years of German,
wow,
2 years of French. I mean, it's a tough school. It was a college preparatory school in those days. I'm not sure what's happened to Boston. It's now, I understand, co-ed now. It was a boys' school in those days. When I was there, they celebrated their tercentenary anniversary. The oldest educational organization, academic organization in the United States, I guess, was Harvard, that had a continuous. And then came, I think that was 1632. And then Boston Latin School was established, as I understand, 1635. So 1935 was 300 years old.
Yeah, wow.
When I moved back to Maine, I guess I was a little bit ahead of the kids who were going to school up in Maine. So I skipped my freshman year of high school. And
now, what was your father doing that you all moved back and forth?
Well, my father, when we lived in Boston, my father was in the fuel business, coal. And when we moved back to Maine, he was still in the fuel business, but it was fuel oil. And there was a new technology, essentially, where people were beginning to convert from dirty old coal to what in those days was cleaner fuel, which was oil. Up in Maine, we didn't have any gas lines, and so people didn't use gas for heating in those days. You'd use gas for cooking, but that would be a result of reducing coke, the coal to coke, and pulling the gas out and then selling the gas. It was during Depression, and the whole family worked. My mother kept the books. My father would be out on the truck. We had a service station, which was really an office, and I guess paid expenses on the truck.
So he owned this company, this
he owned the company.
Small company?
Yeah, it was called Day's Oil Company in those days. My folks never had much money. We paid our bills, but we never had much money. I had two younger brothers. My brother, who's 2 years younger than I do, he skipped 2 years. my own personal feeling is that that probably was a mistake. And he did very well, not for him, but for me. Primarily because although I was certainly academically up with the kids, I graduated at the top of my class, even in high school, I was much younger then. I was okay with the boys, but if you can imagine an 18-year-old girl going out with a 15-year-old boy, that never happened.
Yeah.
And as a senior in high school, I didn't want to go out with a 15-year-old freshman. You know, it was that simple.
Right.
That simple. But I worked all the time. I'd go to school, get back home around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and work with my dad until 10, 11 o'clock at night.
Now, what were your folks' educational level?
They were both high school graduates, but they never had any college education. There never was any question that they had three boys. They didn't have two nickels to rub together, but those three boys were going to go to college.
Mm.
It was a given. We never discussed it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all. Didn't know how it was going to work out, but somehow or other, the three boys were going to go to college. When it was time for me to go to college, I applied for entrance to Bates College, because Bates was a very good liberal arts college, and I was a townie, so I didn't have to worry about paying over the board.
Mm.
I lived at home, and I could still work, which I did. I went to Bates for 4 years, and I majored in chemistry.
How did you choose chemistry?
I just liked chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And chemistry seemed a lot more practical than some of the other things they were teaching in those days. I liked the sciences. There would be no point in majoring in physics back in 1939, is when I entered Bates College. Unless I planned to teach or work for Bell Labs.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't any jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, physics back in 1939 is a lot different than physics today. We had optics and mechanics and things like that, but you know, we didn't have any nuclear or anything. It was relatively rudimentary. Mm-hmm. Compared to what we actually have today. So I applied in chemistry. I could either have majored in chemistry, in biology, or in physics in Bates College in those days. I really wasn't too crazy about biology. I did it, but I did all right. I got good grades, but I really wasn't. So I just liked chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Did you know much about the chemical field in terms of industry possibilities and jobs?
Yeah, well, when I went in, I remember the head of the department talked to me. I was interviewed by him, and he asked me why I wanted to major in chemistry, and I told him. He said, I want to be honest and upfront with you. He said, you're Jewish, aren't you? And I said, yes. He says, well, I just want you to know it's very difficult for Jewish boys to get jobs at chemical firms.
Oh, yeah?
This was before World War II. That's changed.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I said, well, and I'm still going to major in chemistry. World War II came along. I was allowed to finish college, but I couldn't do any honors work because I had to leave in January or February of 1943. A lot of my classmates weren't allowed to finish. Those in the sciences were allowed to finish.
Mm-hmm.
I was interviewed for a job. It was with a small chemical firm called Metal Hydrides in Beverly, Massachusetts. And And I remember going down to Beverly for the interview, and they brought me in the rear entrance, and there was a Railway Express truck out there. And they had little boxes about a foot long and maybe about 4 inches high, and maybe 5-6 inches across. Wooden. And there must have been maybe 15 or 20 of these on the loading edge of this flatbed. And this truck was sitting down low. So, you know, being a brash young guy in those days, said, gee, you ought to do something about those springs. I didn't know what they were working on. Because I didn't have any idea what they were working on in those days. Well, what they were doing is they were reducing, they were trying to, well, they were producing pure uranium, metallic uranium, for the rods that would be used in the first pile, the first reactor.
Is that right?
In Stagg Stadium. I worked there for, let's see, 43. I worked there for about a year. My job was, you know, not a terribly exciting job. It was primarily in analytical chemistry. It was interesting working there because I found out what we were working with. It was not radioactive in that it was pure uranium, and we didn't separate the isotopes or anything like that. But we would have fires, and they would bank those fires with sand, and they would burn and burn and burn. I mean, you just couldn't put them out. It was very heavy uranium.
Yeah.
That's why the truck was out there, because the box would, there would be a solid uranium core like this in those boxes. You see, it was very heavy.
Yeah.
I didn't mind the work. I enjoyed the work. I was living in a small town, Beverly, Massachusetts, is a lovely town. I lived at the YMCA. At night, I'd go into a restaurant to eat, and somebody would always ask me, well, how come you're not in the Army? That's the way it was. And after all, this became grating, and all my friends were in the Army. My younger brother, 2 years younger than I was, he was in the Army. My other brother, one that was 3 years younger than him, he was in the Army before the end of the war. And I just feel I wanted to go into service.
Now, did you have a deferment for working for metal hydride?
I had a deferment. Uh-huh. So there was an Army lieutenant stationed full-time at our plant. And I went to him, and I explained what the problem was. I said, you know, I don't have any social life, because I'm an outcast. I'm considered a draft dodger. Now, I don't mind. I mean, I want to go in the service. I feel very strongly about what we're doing in the service. I want to be part of this. So he said to me, he says, I understand. He said, now, he says, with your background, he says, the Navy's looking for radar officers. And I said, what's radar?
Well, the Germans were asking the same question.
The Germans were asking the same question, and this is where a physics background would have been better than a chemistry background.
Yeah.
Although I had strong math, so it helped. So I went down to, he said, why don't you go into Boston, the first naval districts in Boston, and talk to the people. So I went in, and I was interviewed by some lieutenant commander, and he did everything but kiss me. And I was a young guy, and it looked like I was in halfway decent shape, what have you, and so on. So they gave me a physical, and I passed the physical. He said, I want you to sign this application. So I signed the application. he said, and I have to send this to Washington, but you'll probably hear from me within a week. So a week later, I get a call from this guy. He said, we want you to come down. We want to swear you in. We want to get you uniforms, and we want you to get started. I said, fine. He said, but before you do, he says, you have to get a release from the Army. I says, that's no problem. I said, there's a lieutenant, his name was Batson, something like that. And I said, I'll get the release. So I went to him and I explained. I said, I got good news. The Navy wants me to come down. They want to commission me as an ensign. He says, well, that's just fine. He says, but I can't release you. I said, what do you mean you can't release me?
You're the guy that told me to get out.
What do you mean you can't release me? He says, I have to get this approved in New York. That's where the Manhattan Project came from. It was the headquarters from Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, fine, well, then go get the release. So I called them and I told them that Lieutenant was going to New York, I think it was 2 days after that. And he would get approval from his commander to release me. Well, then he comes back and says, I can't release you. I said, I can't release you. So I was stuck there. So I called the Navy and I talked to this lieutenant commander. He listened to what I said. Well, I was part of his quota, so obviously his quota, he wasn't going to meet his quota, you see. And he was livid. He says, let me tell you something, Dave. I said, yes, sir. He said, don't ever get in the Navy. He says, I'll be looking for you. So I said, yes, sir. I went back to the lieutenant. There was another classmate of mine who was also down there. We were very good friends. He was Armenian extraction. His name was Setrak of Vokhtoderian. He was a chemist, too. We were classmates. I was, 5 feet eight, and he was 6 feet three, so it was kind of mutt and Jeff. But we were very, very good friends. And he was having the same problem I was having. And so we decided that we would leave. So I went to the, we went to the lieutenant, and he said, Lieutenant, we're giving you notice. 2 weeks' notice. And we're going to be leaving in 2 weeks. Well, he wasn't very happy with that at all. And he said, well, you can't leave us. I said, look, if we have to stay another week or 2 weeks, fine. To train somebody, we'll be happy to do that. But we're going to be leaving. And he said, you can't do that. I said, what do you mean I can't do that? I said, I want the Army. I can do anything I want, you see. And so we left, it must have been about 3 weeks later, and I went home, and I went down to my draft board. My mother wasn't terribly happy, but my father understood. Mothers never understand those things. I mean, soldiers, when the young boys go off to war, they don't treat them like that at all. But she accepted it. I went down to the draft board. And I said, my status is now changed. I think I was 2A, 2B, or something like that. I reclassified me as 1A. And they were just delighted. And I said, fine, can you tell me about when I'll be going? Well, in those days, about every 10 days, there'd be a picture of four or five guys down at the railroad station going, you see. Mm-hmm. And I don't get anything that week. And I think, well, must be a slow week, something like that. And then I pick up the newspaper, and there's a guy, group one out, it's not me. So I go down to the draft board. And I said, you reclassed me 1A? No, we didn't reclass me. I said, what do you mean you didn't reclass me 1A? Well, we have this letter from the Army saying that we can't reclassify. You're still 2B. So I said, well, who signed the letter? And they gives me the name of this lieutenant. So I called him. And I said, look, Lieutenant, I just was down at draft one. He says, I can't.
I prepared that letter under orders from New York,
and I can't retract that. But I tell you, I understand why you want to be in uniform. Okay? We've got a place for you, someplace down south. And you'll have a lot more responsible job than you had in Beverly. But we need you, we need your background. I said, will I be in uniform? And he said, well, no. I said, well, I'm not interested. This went on for 3 months, this fight I had with the Army. And finally, one day, I got a letter from my draft board, 1A. And I went into the Army. I was sworn in to Portland, Maine. First went to Fort Devens, and then Fort Devens, we put on trains. We went to Cincinnati, and from Cincinnati, we turned south. And I ended up at Fort McCallum, Alabama. An infantry replacement training center. And if I say so myself, I was a good soldier. I figured, well, I didn't have much competition in those days. I mean, let me tell you, the cream of the crop had already gone.
Yeah. What time of year was this then?
I think it was July.
What a great time.
Before McClellan. Oh, yeah. Hot. We didn't have air-conditioned trains or anything like that. We'd leave the windows open. So everybody was black from the soot. But anyway, we went down to Fort McClellan, Alabama, and I remember we were wearing fatigues. We were wearing fatigues, and some sergeant came around about 15 or 20 minutes before we were scheduled to be wherever. I guess we were in Anniston, about 6 miles from Fort McClellan. And he said, we want you in Class A uniforms. Well, what the hell is a Class A uniform? We didn't know. I mean, we didn't know anything. So we get into these Class A uniforms, and we land in Fort McCallum. And the train pulls in, and there's officers out there, and this train unloads, and all these guys are filthy, sweaty, but Class A uniforms. And we line up, you know. Not that we knew how to do. We knew how to line up and aim, march us on. I remember the officer welcomed us to Fort McClellan and welcomed us to the infantry.
Now this was regular basic infantry training.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. 17 weeks and then 10 days at home and then overseas.
Wow.
Well, I did my training. I was probably a little more responsible than some of the other guys, and I took it a lot more seriously. We had a number of guys in our unit that couldn't read or couldn't write, even though they had been to Army schools and graduated from Army schools, saying that they could read or write. I used to read their wives' letters to them and write their reply to their wives. I mean, it was bad. Now, not everybody was like that, though. You found it was either real young or older guys. And I was more toward the real young, a little more mature than the young guys. We were on bivouac the 16th week, and out in the field, and some lieutenant in a jeep came zooming up to where a group of us were encamped, and they were looking for this guy Day. So I was the only Day in the group, so he loaded me in the back of the jeep and they dropped me off to headquarters. And there was an Army captain there who interviewed me. He put me in a small room, he closed the door, he said to me,
said, what did you do before you came in the Army? Well, I said, I worked as a chemist for the Army. Well, what did you do? I'm sorry, sir, I can't tell you. I mean, I was told before I left and you couldn't say it. Well, he says, what do you mean you can't tell me? He says, I just can't tell you. Well, he says, well, I'm ordering you to tell me. And he says, I'm sorry, Captain, but I just can't tell you. And he laughed. And he says, well, I'm from the same outfit. He said, I want to show you your folder. He takes out a folder. On Mill Day, there was that thick. Okay? They decided if I wanted to go to the Army, they were going to teach me what the infantry was all about. It's a fascinating story. Yeah. So they put me into this. So he said, and he showed me his ID. And he started telling me some stuff that I didn't know, but I didn't want to let on, I didn't know. And he said, well, he said, Dave, he said, we're going to be moving 19 men to Knoxville, Tennessee. And you'll be in charge. Well, you know, I didn't have one stripe, and these guys had one stripe, but I carried the damn service records of everybody, so I was in charge. And he says, I don't want you to say anything to anybody. You'll find out more about what you're going to be doing when you get there. Good luck. And then I guess he had to talk to 18 other guys. My buddy was with a different group, but he was interviewed by him too.
Now, this is your friend from Bates.
Bates, yeah. His name was D.E. Mine started with D.A., so I guess that's why I was in charge. I mean, I'm not really sure I was in charge. But so they put us on a train, and I remember we came to Chattanooga, and you know, these are a bunch of young GIs. They all came to me and said, we want to get off and get a bottle of beer. I said, well, wait a minute. Nobody gets off. I got to find out how long the train's going to be here. I mean, when we're going to be leaving. So I went and looked for the conductor. And the conductor said, we're going to be here for 20 minutes. So I came back and I said, okay, guys, we're out of here in 10 minutes. You know, it's what you have to do. And they all trot off the train to get a bottle of beer. No cans in those days. And I'm sitting there with all these 19 envelopes. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden the train starts to move. And we're in the last car. And so I'm running around trying to find the damn conductor. I'm going to lose 18 guys, you see. And I can't find that train. It's pulling out slow, but it's pulling out, you see. And evidently, one of the guys saw the train starting to pull out. So he hollers to the other. These guys are chasing me up the track, trying to get on this train, you see. And so I got to stop this train. So I run around. I find an emergency door. And I pull that damn emergency door. Let me tell you, the train stopped. Okay? I mean, I landed on the floor, but the train stopped, you see. And pretty soon this conductor comes back, and he is just furious. Who pulled the cord? I said, I pulled the cord. He says, you told me that the train wasn't going to leave for 20 minutes. And I says, and here, I says, we've only been here 7 or 8 minutes, and the train's leaving. And he said, well, I won't tell you what he said. But anyway, by that time, everybody was on. And what we did, we pulled out, and then we backed in on another track. Well, he didn't tell me that. And you're right, we were there for another 10, 15,
probably an hour then. Let me stop this and switch tapes.